Good afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 16th, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on this afternoon's show, philanthropy hasn't ended because of the pandemic. In fact, the organizers of the annual Northwest Arkansas Observance of National Philanthropy Day say giving is more important than ever because of the pandemic. This year's celebration is happening, but virtually, and we'll learn more ahead. Arkansas's new confirmed cases of COVID-19 grew by more than 2,000 this weekend, with an additional more than 650 new probable cases. Total number of new probable and confirmed cases revealed by weekend testing totaled 2,722. There were 32 confirmed deaths from the virus and 3 more probable deaths reported. More than 2,180 deaths from coronavirus have been reported in Arkansas since the pandemic began. Governor Asa Hutchinson's task force for battling the virus during the winter met for the first time this morning, and the governor is scheduled to deliver his weekly remarks about the disease tomorrow afternoon. National Weather Service says clear conditions and cool temperatures tonight with lows between 35 and 40 throughout the listening area. More sunshine expected for Tuesday's forecast with highs around 65 in northwest Arkansas, nearing 70 tomorrow in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. Governmental bodies are becoming more diverse in some communities around Arkansas. While the 15-member Washington County Quorum Court is losing one Hispanic Justice of the Peace, it's gaining two more, Kenny Arnando Loyola and Evelyn Rios Stafford. The latter also has the distinction of being the first openly transgender Arkansan elected to office in the natural state. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Evelyn Rios Stafford didn't join the race until September, and her name never appeared on the ballot. Originally, Candy Clark was the Democratic candidate for Justice of the Peace for Washington County District 12. However, she decided to drop out of the race after suffering a stroke a few months ago. Rios Stafford says the Democratic Party was allowed to appoint a replacement candidate, so they held an election.
And I won the vote, and so I was picked as the replacement candidate in September. So really, that didn't give a lot of time to get a campaign up and running. It was really, a really quick kind of seat of the pants sort of campaign.
Because the candidate change came late in the process, Candy Clark's name still appeared on the ballot. To help educate voters, Rios Stafford and her team crafted the message that Arkansans could vote for Candy Clark to elect Evelyn Rios Stafford. The Washington County Election Commission also helped by including slips of paper that explained the situation with absentee ballots and posting notices at voting booths. In the end, the messaging worked, and according to unofficial results, Rios Stafford defeated Republican Todd Edwin Crane with 65% of the vote to become the first openly transgender candidate elected to office in Arkansas. However, having the distinction of being the first is not why she ran for office.
As I've said to people, I'd rather be known for what I do than who I am. But I also believe that it's important because for a couple reasons. One is visibility. When people get to know someone who's LGBTQ, they're far more likely to support equality. And the other reason is, when there's positive role models living and thriving, it allows other people to imagine new possibilities for themselves. I like to say, your dreams and your identity are not mutually exclusive. I think it sends a message to folks that no matter who you are, you can succeed at anything in life.
Rios Stafford also represents the Latino community. She says it's her understanding she'll be only the third or fourth Latinx person to serve on the Washington County Quorum Court.
That's another way in which representation is really important. I think that Washington County is a very diverse county. It's becoming more diverse every year. And our elected representation hasn't necessarily been keeping up with that diversity. And so, it's time to... it's good to see those sorts of changes happening.
The election of Rios Stafford has gained much attention, and she hopes to have a positive impact in her new role.
Since that news started going out, the number of young LGBTQ people who I've noticed who've started following me on social media, it really touches me. You know, it really makes me feel gratified that hopefully, I'm being a role model for the next generation.
During the campaign, Evelyn Rios Stafford focused on accountability and transparency and plans to implement those things as a new justice of the peace.
You know, my belief is the quorum court, you know, which is the body that the justice of the peace sit on, shouldn't just be a rubber stamp. They shouldn't just be a rubber stamp for the decisions of the county judge. We should really look carefully at, you know, at everything and ask tough questions when they need to be asked.
In addition to working with budgets, justices of the peace can perform marriage ceremonies. It's a duty Rios Stafford is looking forward to.
I feel like it's just so special and beautiful to be involved in someone's day like that. JPs often get chosen by secular couples, interfaith couples, and same-sex couples. And I believe everyone should have a choice of someone they feel comfortable with performing their marriage. I'm a strong supporter of marriage equality. I believe that no matter who you are, who you love, your wedding day should be just as special as mine was. And so I'm glad to be able to provide couples with a choice of someone that they feel comfortable with performing their wedding ceremony.
Evelyn Rios Stafford will begin her 2-year term on the Washington County Quorum Court in January. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
There are hundreds of traditional school districts in Arkansas. There are also 24 public enrollment charter districts classified as free experimental learning environments. According to new State Department of Education data, while traditional districts in Arkansas have lost thousands of students due to the pandemic, charter school districts are gaining in enrollment. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
Modern band class students at Arkansas Arts Academy in Rogers, known as the Carbonados, performed 8 days a week by the Beatles at a winter concert last January. Auditorium filled with students, teachers, and parents just weeks before a global pandemic was declared. Richard Burrows is CEO of the Arkansas Arts Academy, which operates a K-12 elementary school and high school, a total of 1,200 in attendance.
And our mission is to provide a really rigorous academic program with a very purposeful integration of the arts at every grade level in all 4 or 5 art forms, depending on how you consider that, because that would include music, dance, theater, visual arts, and media arts experiences.
Arkansas Arts Academy, the second oldest and one of the largest public charter districts in Arkansas, reopened for in-person classes this fall after going virtual last winter.
The decision was made that we would attempt to have a blended learning opportunities or alternative learning opportunities. And so we wanted to ensure that our students would still get a modest amount of in-person dance, music, theater, and visual arts instruction so that half of the students would be able to come 2 days a week, in-person instruction. After those 2 days, the instruction would flip, and we would have the ones that who had done virtual instruction come to school, and those who had been at school would go to virtual instruction.
The blended instruction, Burrow says, is very new, with teachers having to create both in-class and at-home curricula. large group music, art, and performing arts classes are carefully orchestrated to prevent virus transmission, he says.
Or that in the case of instrumental music, they can work with the wind instruments alone, or they can work with the violins alone. And then there's still practice and good work that goes on virtually.
Of 262 public school districts in Arkansas, 24 are charter school districts, which operate free public experimental schools closely monitored by a state charter authorizing board. The Arkansas Department of Health publishes COVID-19 positive data by public school district based on local community cases. Charter school district data is not broken out, given charter districts enroll students across traditional school district borders. But as of October 26th, 1,090 faculty and staff, along with 3,300 students, have tested positive for COVID-19, according to the Arkansas Department of Health.
And I'm saying this anecdotally because we have no way to prove it one way or the other, but I do believe that students are not coming to school and contracting the virus while they're at the school site because we're so careful in our protocols. The schools are cleaned and deep cleaned on a regular basis. And only once have we had to send the entire school home for a week of virtual instruction when an adult at the school who had contact with a large part of the student population tested positive.
The positive case at the Arkansas Arts Academy occurred in the high school, which temporarily closed mid-October. Burroughs says districts are prohibited from disclosing the identity of positive cases. We queried Northwest Arkansas Classical Academy in Bentonville for this report with no response, which also had to temporarily close an elementary school in early October due to a COVID-19 positive case. And according to Tiffany Despain, a school nurse and instructor at Haas Hall Academy District, her four 7th through 12th grade campuses in Fayetteville, Bentonville, Springdale, and Rogers have not been forced to go all virtual, a consequence of someone testing positive.
Every scholar, every day, college bound. So we're a college preparatory institution.
That's Haas Hall Superintendent Martin Schottmeyer. He's proud to be founder of one of the first and most academically noted charter schools in Arkansas.
And we have 100% graduation and 100% college acceptance rate.
Haas Hall students, he says, can opt for virtual, blended, or in-classroom instruction with faculty teaching homeschool and in-school courses simultaneously.
You know, it's about a third initially. When we started this, it's gone to about 40% now full-time at school.
Operating a college prep academy during a global pandemic offers certain learning opportunities, Schottmeyer says. Last year, around 1,000 students were enrolled. This year, enrollment is up by 50%.
Yeah, we're all in this together, and we're all looking at this pandemic and hoping that it will end soon, but realistically speaking, we're ready to take it on as long as we need to.
Joanna Levers, Director of Charter Development at the Arkansas Public School Resource Center in Little Rock.
Some of the charter schools were already providing remote or virtual instruction, so not much change was required for them. But they've had their fair share of challenges as well due to COVID. And it's because their enrollment has increased significantly.
Lever is referring to charter districts in Arkansas reckoning with new enrollment demand. According to new data posted by the Arkansas Department of Education, by contrast, traditional public schools are losing students.
It shows that state enrollment overall is down around 6,400 students. And that's in all schools, but the enrollment in charter schools has actually increased from 2020 to 2021 by 3,898 students.
Lever says charter schools with limited enrollment may be more nimble in meeting remote learning as well as safety procedures during the pandemic compared to traditional schools.
You know, the design principles that the charter community is found on are centered around innovation. And so some of the public charter schools were able to rapidly deploy teachers and technology to reach students and keep the learning moving forward.
Which traditional public schools strive towards as well, Lever says. Charter schools that receive a surplus of new student applications are required by state law to host blind lotteries to fairly select incoming students.
You know, right now, the percentage of students accessing the fully virtual open enrollment charter schools has grown by about 65% from 2020 to 2021. And those fully virtual statewide charter schools would include Arkansas Connections Academy and Arkansas Virtual Academy.
Arkansas Virtual Academy, a K-12 public charter school located in Pulaski County, counted 2,500 students last year. This year, nearly 3,900 are enrolled. As for Arkansas Connections Academy in Bentonville, also a virtual school, nearly 2,800 students are enrolled, up from around 1,600 last year. But charter districts located in working poor communities are seeing steep enrollment declines, a possible consequence of the pandemic. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A reminder that if you can't always be near your radio at noon or 7 p.m. for daily editions of Ozarks at Large, you're still close to Ozarks at Large. Just ask your smart speaker at any time to please play Ozarks at Large. You'll hear the most recent daily edition of our show. And you can always go to ozarksatlarge.com to hear that show and hear individual stories and interviews. ozarksatlarge.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. It's your chance to win a gift from KUAF and one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Pack Rat Outdoor Center, Arcom Plus, Therapod Float Spa, Arkansas Public Theater, and more. Winners announced Friday, December 11th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Details and registration available at KUAF.com.
Each November, the Northwest Arkansas chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals celebrates philanthropy on National Philanthropy Day with a gathering of hundreds at the Town Center in downtown Fayetteville. But this year, the hundreds will have to gather virtually. The 2020 event can be found at the AFP Northwest Arkansas Facebook page. It takes place Wednesday, beginning at 11:30. Earlier this month, we reached Elizabeth Pringer, National Philanthropy Day co-chair, Kelly Knight, the Assistant Vice Chancellor for University Development at the University of Arkansas, and Emily Ironside, Director of Development at Crystal Bridges and the Momentary. The University of Arkansas is this year's presenting sponsor of the National Philanthropy Day event, and Emily Ironside is being recognized as the 2020 Outstanding Fundraising Executive. Elizabeth Pringer says it is important to recognize the role of philanthropy in Northwest Arkansas, whether doing so in person or virtually.
This is such an important thing to celebrate, especially this year more than ever, getting together and recognizing the work that's being done, you know, year after year after year, but then especially this year in particular. We thought it would be appropriate to add an additional category to recognize those individuals or organizations that are really making an impact with COVID needs, relief efforts. This year, we just thought it was extra important to have an opportunity to celebrate.
Kelly Knight, you know, we all know that philanthropy is a 365, maybe 364 day a year business. Have you seen any change in 2020 as compared to other years when it comes to philanthropy?
Yes, I think we have seen a shift. It has been positive in a lot of ways and very few negatives, as we would have assumed going into the COVID-19 quarantine period and a lot of businesses shutting down. So we all kind of took a pause, I feel like, for a couple of months. And then the university was finishing up a capital campaign. And so we were in a very precarious situation of what to do as we debated on moving forward. But it was the alumni and constituents of the university that pushed us forward. So philanthropy spirit was still well alive with our constituency. And they actually said, continue and we'll meet the goal and exceed it. And we did. And then we saw, you know, just kind of a couple of month period. And then people started becoming alive again and supporting all of the various organizations, large and small in Northwest Arkansas. And so, and with gifts of various sizes. That's what's so exciting, Kyle, is that someone can make a smaller contribution, but it still goes a long way in helping the particular organization or fundraising initiative in achieving the goals. So we all need to come together to help this community stay viable, stay alive, and get past this pandemic, as we know we will.
Emily Ironside, I want to bring you into the conversation. Philanthropy, development, like everything else, has been changed, and this change is happening seemingly daily or hourly. What has that been like? Have the conversations been different between you and your fellow development professionals, between you and your relationships in development?
Yes, Kyle. In all of those areas, absolutely. You know, when the pandemic first hit in March, we had just opened the Momentary. It had a great 3 weeks of being open before it closed. And the Crystal Bridges closed for a period of a couple of months as well. And our team, you know, once we got settled and figured out what a home office situation would be like and how we were going to navigate, some of us being parents and working professionals, we thought, what is the number one thing we need to consider? And it's our donors, it's our people, it's our cheerleaders and our advocates that are out there. And so we spent a couple of months just on call time and really establishing even closer connections to many of our donors than we might have had in normal operations. And so for us, that was in many ways a silver lining, because people were coming together as a community, as individuals who cared about one another. And we would spend an hour or more sometimes talking to our donors about life, not necessarily even about a gift or the museum per se. And so that was different for us to just have that focused time just to be on phone calls and visit with our donors. And then we emerged from that and realized, okay, we have to rethink how we are engaging them throughout the year. And we have done a combination of virtual programs and in-person smaller gatherings, distance gatherings. But as many of our development professionals around Northwest Arkansas, event planning is one of the skills we bring to the table. We are not trained in virtual communications, and that is a very different animal. So all of our colleagues, both the Crystal Bridges Momentary and across Northwest Arkansas and all of our various nonprofits, had to very quickly become apt at Zoom and virtual platforms and virtual silent auctions and completely different skill set in many ways. And so we've had to adapt personally in our own lives, but also professionally in the skills that are making us viable today.
Certainly, I think one thing we've learned in 2020 is that the foundations that were important, education, culture, aid, they're magnified now.
Oh, absolutely, Kyle. You know, and I think, you know, I'm coming from the museum industry, and we are redefining what a museum is and how we should serve our community during this time. And I'm seeing that happen across the country as well. And partnerships here in Northwest Arkansas that have formed between Crystal Bridges and Northwest Arkansas Food Bank and Seven Hills Homeless Shelters and a variety of women's shelters in the area. And we've partnered on meal deliveries with local schools, and we've done personal care kits to shelters and organizations that aid those in need. And that necessarily will change once COVID, you know, we're beyond the COVID pandemic, but it may change in how we're partnering with them, but those partnerships will last throughout this. So I feel as if in many ways the fabric of our community and the nonprofit community has really pulled together in new ways that I think will make all of us stronger after this pandemic, because we realize we have to count on one another. We all serve different needs within the community, and how do we use each other to kind of build strength and expand that impact that each of us have If we continue to work in silos, that's not going to serve Northwest Arkansas. So certainly this pandemic has helped us, pushed us to really think beyond our walls at Crystal Bridges in the momentary, and how do we partner with those amazing organizations that are out there serving basic needs of our community each and every day, and how do we help bolster what they're doing using art as our lens. We've certainly been able to make a great deal of impact in spaces we never would have thought was possible before the pandemic. So it's more important now than ever. I mean, I'm so committed to being a nonprofit professional, and each and every day we're reminded of the need and our ability to help. And that's the silver lining. You know, the commitment is stronger than ever, for sure.
Well, the University of Arkansas is proud to be the presenting sponsor. We think National Philanthropy Day 2020 is going to be the best yet. Elizabeth and her committee have done a fabulous job planning this virtual celebration, and we have wonderful recipients such as Emily and others that we're so excited to come together and celebrate. The spirit of philanthropy is alive and well in Northwest Arkansas, and we are going to continue to make an impact for all of the lives. And so we're happy to continue that tradition, even through a little bit different model than in years past.
The virtual observation of National Philanthropy Day, hosted by the Northwest Arkansas chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals, will be Wednesday morning, beginning at 11:30. You can find it through a link at the chapter's Facebook page. We heard from Elizabeth Pringer, National Philanthropy Day co-chair, Kelly Knight, the Assistant Vice Chancellor for University Development at the University of Arkansas, and Emily Ironside, Director of Development at Crystal Bridges and the Momentary. We mentioned earlier, Emily is the 2020 Outstanding Fundraising Executive. Others being recognized at Wednesday's event include the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank, the Schmieding Foundation, Unilever, Jane Hunt Mead, Mandy Mackey, Northwest Arkansas Council, and Fayetteville High School Student Council. This is Ozarks at Large. It's Monday, so it is time to invite Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History back to Ozarks at Large. We're going to listen to archives that have been digitized thanks to the Tyson Family Foundation, digitized from KATV newscasts. Randy, welcome back to Ozarks at Large. We're going to hear our first archive in a moment, but I think it's fair to tell listeners that this is a substantially serious topic that is covered this week.
This is a pretty heavy one, yes.
With that just little bit of disclaimer, let's listen to the first sound we have, which is actually not from a digitized archive cut, but from someone who witnessed what we're going to talk about.
The first one was troubling, and I still can see the inmate on the gurney, and just his loses his color, his skin goes gray, and you could sense and see the life going out of him.
All right, Randy, who did we just hear, and what are we talking about this week?
Well, that was Kelly Kissel, who is now with the Baton Rouge Advocate, and he was with the Associated Press back in 1994, and this is kind of a new segment we're doing. When we used to do a newscast at KTV, we would call it the broadcast of record, or we would call it the news of the day. So now that the Media Preserve is starting to digitize more and more material and videotapes, they're starting and working up in 1994. So I'm beginning to get full newscasts from 1994. And I came across this one from August the 3rd of 94. And what made it significant is it was the day of a triple execution.
You're watching America's number one ABC station, KATV Channel 7, The Spirit of Arkansas. Now, live with Arkansas's most watched news team, this is Channel 7 News at 10.
That is the opening of the newscast from that date. Arkansas had not committed an execution for a while, and then the executions began. They had not had a triple execution, that is, three people executed the same day in decades.
That's correct. And they did them one per hour, 7, 8, and 9 o'clock. And of course, it was a national news story, and we were there to cover it. This is reporter Rob Johnson, who was there live all day at Cummins Prison.
The Cummins unit was abuzz Wednesday afternoon as all parties took their places. By late afternoon, a three-judge panel had issued a stay for James Holmes, saying he should be able to prove that he had inadequate counsel. Several hours later, the full Eighth Circuit overruled the stay.
The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, on an 8-2 vote, has voted to overturn the stay on Holmes.
That meant all three executions were a go. The first to die, 37-year-old Hoyt Klines.
We had prayer together before he left his cell with the policeman, and then I walked with him to the door. He did not have any last words.
A lethal injection was administered at 7:01 p.m., and the coroner has pronounced Hoyt Franklin Klines dead at 11 p.m. I'm sorry, 7:11 p.m. The rest of the time he looked straight up, then he closed his eyes, and he never reopened them. It was as if he were going to sleep.
You were working at KATV at that time, correct?
Yes. I was the assistant news director and executive producer and was in charge of most of our remote coverage. So I was there for this event. I probably covered more than a dozen executions. And what they would do is that they would have a handful of witnesses, family members, things like that, but they would pick one media member to act as a witness, and everyone who was there representing print, wire service, television, radio, their names would go in a hat, and they would draw a name, and that person would be a witness. And Kelly Kissel, as you heard there near the end of that report, witnessed one of the three executions, and this was actually, he had only been in Little Rock for a couple of weeks, and this was his first of 10.
Now, you talked to him.
Yes, and I talked to him the other day down in Baton Rouge and just wanted to get his sort of reflections on what kind of effect it had on him, because I never knew how I would react. As you know, a journalist, you go in there to do your job, but gosh, that's kind of a tough pill.
Going into the first one, I was a little curious about how it was going to make me feel. I really didn't have any attitudes toward the death penalty one way or the other, and especially as a journalist. I mean, the idea was going in was that, okay, this is the way the state has decided to address these crimes. And so my role was basically to go in there and report it just as, okay, the state did this. I have to admit that afterward, the morning after, I didn't really feel that much different about what I had just witnessed. And it troubled me a little bit. And in fact, at that point, and then after some of the other executions, I actually visited a priest and questioned whether or not my taking a role in that, because the state of Arkansas requires you to sign paperwork saying that you were a witness of these executions. I was kind of curious as to whether or not that was an active enough role to have been a sin on my part of, you know, actively working, you know, for or taking part in somebody's death. And I wasn't really sure. I guess at the end of the day, it's like, no, I mean, as a journalist, it's still something that I think journalists especially have to do. I mean, we have to report on what the state is doing to its citizens. And in this case, you know, and certainly in Arkansas's case, for 30 people in the last 30 years or so, you know, they've executed people in the death chamber. And in my role as a journalist, that has to be covered. And so so to this day, I really don't have any qualms about what I did.
It's Kelly Kissel, who in 1994 was working for the Associated Press based in Little Rock and witnessed the one of the triple executions that took place in Arkansas. And that day, before we hear more of the archives, I want to ask you, so Randy, if you were producing the remote broadcast, you would be there on location. Would you be in a truck? Would you be outside on the grounds? What would your role be during those newscasts?
Well, I was in the truck, and I would coordinate the photographers, reporters. We would edit the stories together there, and it all happened, of course, very quickly. And we prepared a report for the late news that night.
Well, one of the things that was on the newscast from August 3rd, 1994 was reaction from the wife and daughter of a man who had been murdered. Let's hear that.
I woke up this morning and my first thought was, this is the day they will die. I would like these men to know that if they would have come knocking on our door for employment or for help, my father would have done what he could to help them. This is the type of man they have killed.
I think the judicial system benefits the criminals and not the victims. It should not take years to get justice done.
And I will always remember August the 3rd as that day, just as I will remember January the 8th as the day my father died.
We're listening to some archives from the Pryor Center. This one from, most of these cuts that we're hearing are from a single newscast day from August 3rd, 1994, when Arkansas executed three men. I want to ask you also about the decision for who from the media would witness the execution. You said names were put in a hat or a bowl or something and pulled out. Could you request as a media member to not have your name in there, or was that part of the deal? If you were there, your name had to go
in. I'm not sure. I don't know that anyone ever requested that they not.
Mm.
I think everyone thought it was their duty to be included in that, and if they were asked to, they would.
Well, I bring... go ahead.
Well, and Kelly was the same way. You know, I asked him about how it affected him personally and professionally, and you know, he basically looked at it as his job and an important thing to do. But it did, as you'll hear here, affected him.
After about the fifth or the sixth one, I was on a retreat at Subiaco and went to confession during that. And I had witnessed an execution, and I had the same questions. I mean, I didn't necessarily go in there to confess a sin or anything like that, but I just asked the priest, I said, you know, what his thoughts were. And he actually posed the question of, well, what makes me think that this isn't the way God wants that person to go out? Because obviously, you know, if you get an execution date, then that's going to weigh heavily on your mind and on your soul. And maybe it helps purge, that sin or the murder or the homicide or whatever, that put you on death row, that maybe knowing the date that you're going to die actually works on the salvation of the murderer's soul, and that was something that I really hadn't explored as to, I mean, I was so worried about what the impact on me was that I didn't, worry about the impact on the inmate. And maybe, maybe he had a point, maybe there is something to that.
Kelly Kissel talking about, talking with a priest about his, I don't know if you'd say role, but his, what he was involved in with witnessing executions. You say he eventually witnessed 10 of them.
Yes.
Mm. Now, when you're producing these segments for a newscast, what kind of conversations do you have with your colleagues about what do we cover, what do we include, how do we approach this?
Well, and this next little bit is a perfect example of that. There was a family of one of the killers, one of the murderers who was being executed, who showed up. And we made the decision to interview them and use their side of the story. We did get some complaints from people saying they should not be heard from, they should not get a voice at all, there should be no sympathy for a murderer's family. And we chose, and it wasn't my sole decision, it was a joint decision from, my boss and the other members of the newsroom, to go ahead and hear their side of it. And, you know, going back to what Kelly said, his priest told him that might have been sort, you know, part of the plan for this person to be executed as part of, you know, God's plan.
As the clock struck seven, members of the Kleins family began to mourn the loss of their third cousin, Hoyt Kleins. He was the first of the inmates to be executed Wednesday night. The family spent the entire afternoon huddled around a tree, consoling one another. They received the news of their cousin's death at 11 minutes after seven.
Oh, I feel like he should die. Because he didn't kill.
I told you.
Kleins' family grieved for him as well as for the family of the victim.
That I regret this very, very much. And I'm sorry that some of my people were involved. Know what they went through.
You going through the same thing now yourself?
I'm going through the same thing.
I feel so sorry for them. Because I know that that moment of anguish, of knowing that something was going wrong, that they couldn't have no control, just like this.
Members of a family of one of the men executed. What was it like, Randy, when, whether it was a triple execution or single execution, it's happened, the interviews are done, you're getting back, and because you're going to have to drive back to Little Rock. What was the conversation like on the way back? Was it quiet? I mean, it's such a heavy, heavy subject to be covering and bringing to the residents of Arkansas.
Well, it was usually quiet about half the way back. You know, we were just south of Pine Bluff, and it was about an hour and a half drive, and we'd start to talk. And what always struck me, because I covered, like I say, more than a dozen, and I just thought about the irony of all of this manpower, resources, not only from the state, from the prison system, but from the media. That, you know, we're going out and doing this to watch or report on someone being put to death. I just thought it was ironic. I don't know. I'm not going to go into whether I,
sure,
you know, am pro or anti death penalty, but I saw the irony in it.
As we've mentioned a couple times, Kelly Kissel, eventually, as a journalist, witnesses 10 executions. When you talked to him the other day, you reached him in Baton Rouge, you asked him a question about the future.
Yeah, I would do it just out of a sense of duty to the world that, okay, this is what I saw. I don't have a stand on the death penalty for or against. I will just tell you what happened.
I think whenever a government decides to end a person's life, it's news. Did you ever get pushback from people about whether you should be covering it or you were doing it too much, or it was?
No, not really. Because you could make the argument that it was news.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
You know, I had a, you know, and it's out of the ordinary, and that's something that you have to cover. Now, you know, as far as it being a news event, after you've covered a dozen, it's—I hate to say it—but it's kind of the same.
Yeah, a routine, I suppose, develops.
Yeah.
All right. So, moving away from the heavier material.
Yeah. Sorry to cheer you down there.
That's okay. We should point out that, you know, prior to this conversation, most of our material has been from the 50s, 60s, and 70s because that was most of the material that was getting digitized. This seems to indicate 80s and 90s are now beginning to come into our availability.
First 90s and 2000s, and then they're going to back up to the earlier videotape, which would be late 70s to mid 90s. So,
okay.
And over that time, the files and the video became more organized.
That's
why we have full newscasts and not just snippets like we've been running, which is great because there's more of a record.
Right.
So if you want a date that we have, you could go back and I could put together highlights from not only the news of the day, but the weather and the sports. If there was a big sports event or a big weather event, it's a great way to, you know, deconstruct a newscast.
So if I said I would be interested in July 5th, 1993, you'd be able to find that.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, eventually, sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, we could take requests.
Huh. Yeah, give us a date out of 365. Put the Pryor Center into a search engine. It'll take you there. There's more than what Randy and I talk about. There's all these interviews with important people in Arkansas's past. If you've got, you know, between an hour and a month to go down the rabbit hole, you'll be highly entertained.
It's a lot of fun.
It is. Randy, these, even when it's very serious, it's still interesting and exciting to hear from Arkansas's past. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. I'll see you next week.
The Arkansas Natural Sky Association reminds everyone that light pollution is not just about losing sight of the stars. Light pollution wastes energy and impacts wildlife, climate, and human health. More information regarding where and how to protect, preserve, and enjoy natural state skies is available online at DarkSkyArkansas.org. It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. It's your chance to win a gift from KUAF and one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Biotech Pharmacal, Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, the Bank of Fayetteville, and more. Winners announced Friday, December 11th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Details and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large, the annual Arkansas Upland Hardwood Management Tour this year, because of the pandemic, will be virtual tomorrow from 1 to 3. Kyle Cunningham, Associate Professor of Forestry with the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture, says the virtual site tour will examine management of oak forests, especially valuable white oaks.
You may have timber as part of your management, or you may have wildlife management, or aesthetic values or something like that. You could have many values or many objectives or many reasons for managing your woodland. And so what we try to do is to provide some tools that improve the health and productivity of your forest, and it helps you meet multiple objectives.
The tour, geared for family forest landowners, forest managers, wildlife biologists, and others, will cover prescribed fire and thinning, including herbicide use, to improve forest stands for oak regeneration.
We're going to spend a lot of time talking about how you would regenerate an old forest. Many of the woodlands across the Ozark region are aging, and so it is time for many landowners to think about. I know, you know, we don't like to cut down those large oak trees oftentimes, but there comes a point when we need to get some new ones growing. And so those are some of the things we're going to be talking about during
the UA Forestry Division has four research stations with sizable woodlands across the state, which are traditional tour sites. This year's tour is taking place at the Batesville station.
And typically once a year, once every other year, we'll have landowners come out to the station and see the research and demonstration work and management that we have going on at the Livestock and Forestry Research Station at Batesville. We have probably about 2,000 acres of upland hardwoods there on the station. And, you know, this is a great time of year to get out there. And typically we'll load up on the hay wagons and that kind of thing and spend a great day in the woods during the fall. But obviously with the pandemic, we can't do that this year. And so we're bringing the woods to the people and to our clientele. And so we have a series of stops that we've pre-recorded,
where demonstration sites will be shown and questions fielded. Registration can take place by calling the research station. It's area code 870-793-7432. You can also register online at bit.ly/virtualhardwoodtour. We do have that link at ozarksatlarge.com. And the virtual tour, absolutely free of charge. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Paris. Antoinette Grajeda, a contributor to this Monday show, as was Jacqueline Froelich. Jacqueline also gave us the news and information about the Hardwood Tour. Our thanks to Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for another Monday trip through Arkansas history. Timothy Dennis produced our show, and our theme is performed and written by Daryl Sean. You can find Daryl many afternoons around 4 o'clock our time at his Facebook and Instagram feeds, playing and taking requests. You can always find out more about us online at OzarksAtLarge.com. Thanks so much for being with us this Monday. Please take care of yourself. I'm Kyle Kellums. We'll talk again real soon.